Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Der Podcast.
Herzlich willkommen, ich bin Sibylle Salewski. Ihr seid jung und wollt es auch bleiben? Warum eigentlich?
Life sucks and then you die. Jetzt ist der Spaß vorbei. The glorification of childhood and youth in the view of everything else after that as a letdown is really quite new. How few people who've retained a clear memory of their 20s would actually choose to repeat them. People generally get happier as they get older. In the end, I believe that fear of growing up is less a fear of dying than a fear of life itself. Or do you really believe the best thing would have been never to have been born?
Erwachsen sein, erwachsen werden. Darum geht es an diesem Wochenende bei uns im Hörsaal. Wir reden aber nicht über Hormone, sondern wir packen das Thema von der philosophischen Seite an. Was heißt das eigentlich, erwachsen zu sein? Heißt das Verantwortung übernehmen, vernünftig, langweilig, spießig werden und im Eigenheim versauern? Warum sollte man das wollen? Wäre es da nicht besser, wie Peter Pan, ewig Kind zu bleiben? Das scheint zumindest attraktiver zu sein. Und ist es nicht vielleicht sogar moralisch besser? Denn es sind doch die Erwachsenen, die Kriege führen, die Umwelt zerstören und im Laufe ihres Lebens langsam verbittern. Nichts da, sagt die Philosophin Susan Neiman. Sie findet, es ist höchste Zeit, dem Erwachsenwerden und Erwachsensein sein verstaubtes Image zu nehmen. Also hat sie ein Buch geschrieben. Warum erwachsen werden, heißt es. Ihre Antwort mag überraschen, aber das nur auf den ersten Blick. Erwachsen zu werden ist ein politischer Akt, sagt Susan Neiman. Erwachsen sein heißt, etwas vom Leben zu wollen und es zu gestalten. Kurz gesagt heißt es, ein mündiger Bürger oder eine mündige Bürgerin zu sein und sich das Leben nicht von Staat oder Obrigkeiten vorgeben zu lassen. Eine emanzipatorische Tat also, das Erwachsenwerden. Und das hat übrigens auch schon der Philosoph Immanuel Kant gesagt. Why Grow Up? Director's Cut lautet der Titel von Susan Neimans Vortrag. Daran erklärt sie die wichtigsten Thesen und Argumente aus ihrem Buch und geht auf die Diskussion ein, die es ausgelöst hat. Susan Neiman hat ihren Vortrag am 11. Juni 2015 am Einstein-Forum in Potsdam gehalten, im Rahmen der Tagung Why Grow Up. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Isn't the question why grow up just the question we all have to answer? I think that it is. And there isn't any particular expertise about it that could help one answer it other than the willingness to think. Even many of my good friends disagree with me. Indeed, some of them expressed dismay and even disgust when they heard I was writing about the subject. That dismay is telling, for the people who expressed it are among the most successful grown-ups I know. I'm not talking about conventional success, though some of them have that in spades, but something else. The ability to stay radiantly, glowingly alive to the world and its possibilities, to be equally open to learning from an ancient text or a market woman on a street corner, and to acknowledge the depths of the very concrete evils that permeate the world, and still be determined to face them down where they can, to call out monstrosities where they occur and rejoice in every bit of beauty that comes their way, to know the difference between poetry and kitsch is finer than often supposed, and to recognize it all the same. Such people, it's often said, are young at heart. Do we consider what we lose when we say things like that? Or compliment a new acquaintance for looking younger than the age she's just named? Consider the fact that no one under the age of, say, 25 wants to hear it. Tell a 7 or a 14 or a 21-year-old that they look younger and you're likely to be met with an insulted pout. They want nothing more than to be perceived as older, that is, mature, competent, self-determined, powerful. Those of us over 30, by contrast, will feel a tinge of something between pride and relief when someone tells us we look younger than we are. We don't pause to think how our acceptance of an equation between looking young and looking good, or being young at heart and being open to the world, spells our own doom, but it does. For it suggests that we can only be perceived as appealing when we appear to be what we're not. Many of the more honest among us try to avoid that duplicity by taking the bull by the horns and joking round about the age of 50 about being over the hill, by talking, for instance, about having a senior moment, when they forget something that anyone in their 30s might just confidently dismiss as unmemorable. I always found such jokes painful and slightly buffoonish, reflecting unnecessary help or haplessness in the joker. But it's only recently I began to think about what such apparently harmless banalities do to the young. When they see us longing to return to an age they long to get over, what futures can they have in view? Each one of them knows that our well-meant injunction to savor the best years of their lives is a problem, for those years are terribly hard. With little experience and even less self-assurance, they make their first decisions with the conviction that every decision is fateful. This love story, this course of study, this job will forever after determine the course of their lives. Add to that the pressure that they're failing at savoring, for their lives, they're constantly told, will only get harder, and you have a recipe for misery that marks the third decade of life. They know how uncertain and torn and confused they are. Where the culture continually tells them this is the best it will ever get, what hopes can they have? And given how few people who've retained a clear memory of their 20s would actually choose to repeat them, and given that a variety of cross-cultural studies show that people generally get happier as they get older, the point of the false message can only be political in a very broad sense. By describing the hardest decade of one's life as the best one, we prepare young people to expect very little of the world and demand even less. Our veneration of youth hurts all of us, for it primes us to view life itself as a slow slide downhill. Now, this is in fact the standpoint of something known as Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man. You didn't be a Shakespeare scholar to have heard the speech from which it was taken, but remarkably, most Shakespeare scholars call it that too. People were dividing the life cycle into seven stages long before Shakespeare, but it's his description that stuck. Let's hear it in full.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and mourning, shining face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school. Then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths, bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again towards childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything.
Now, Morgan Freeman exudes the sort of self-assured wisdom we rightly associate with grown-ups. In his take, it takes on the sort of authority that only a fool would contest. But I'd like to ask you to look at the content of what he's so eloquently recited. All the world's a stage, which means the men and women on it are merely playing roles that have all been written beforehand. Babies are not wondrous, they're not even cute. They mule and puke in the nurse's arms. Lovers are not passionate or poetic, they sigh like a furnace, belching woeful drivel, and so on it continues to the last scene of all sans teeth, sans eyes, sans everything. It's the best statement I ever heard of, you know, claim life sucks and then you die, right? Now, most every contemporary study of human development refers to Shakespeare's Seven Ages, and though publications like Psychology Today try to soften the blows by urging its readers to use the gym and take advantage of modern dentistry, the references are so ubiquitous that while researching this book, I went back to read As You Like It. I couldn't remember the context, but I never expected to be so surprised by it. The speech is made by somebody whose name is spelled Jacques, but an Englishman assured me it's always pronounced Jake, so we'll call him Jake. Jake is a courtier who describes himself as being so melancholy that I can suck melancholy out of a song the way a weasel sucks eggs. Jake's melancholy is so extreme that none of the other characters in the play take him seriously. The grimness of his speech is a comic device, and it gives us about as much insight into Shakespeare's view of the life cycle as one of Lady Macbeth's speeches tells us about Shakespeare's view of morality. Of course, like all of Shakespeare, it tells us something about humankind. We've all met people like Jake. Yet it's hardly popular magazines that persist in ascribing Jake's bleak view to Shakespeare. Shakespeare scholars do it too. Just look at the panels in the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, or the fact that in 1896, a group of Shakespeare lovers raised money to install stained glass windows on the theme in the Stratford Church where the bard is buried. Since he was as good at writing comedy as he was at tragedy, it's as easy to imagine him turning in his grave with laughter as with tears. I bring this example to underline how thoroughly we collude in our own undoing. We misread Shakespeare to give the gloomiest possible picture of human existence an air of authority. This may be partly a matter of psychic insurance. Optimists, after all, face multiple disappointments, while pessimists can only be pleasantly surprised. But I think something deeper is going on here, which I'll try to tease out some more. First, we might ask, how long has this been going on? Note that Jake's speech doesn't simply view adulthood as a bad bargain. From his perspective, all of life is a bust. And that view was already recorded by Sophocles. The second best thing is to die early, the first would have been to never be born. The glorification of childhood and youth, however, and the view of everything else after that as a letdown is really quite new. Nor is it by any means universal. A couple of weeks ago, I was doing a US call-in radio show when a man from the Bronx named Jim called to say that he, for one, had always been glad to grow up, though his childhood had not been unpleasant. The next day, I got a long, thoughtful email from another listener named Sherman, who agreed with Jim, saying that judging by his voice, Jim, too, was a black American, and that nostalgia for one's childhood is a white thing. Though Sherman, too, described his childhood as in most ways idyllic, even in the segregated South. Now, anecdotal evidence is just that, enough to make a white woman feel guilty about her ignorance, but a growing and extensive body of work in anthropology suggests that nostalgia for childhood really is confined to a small percentage of the world's population, those of us who were raised in cultures that anthropologists called weird, as in Western educated, industrial, rich democracies. Here I've learned much from the work of David Lancey, whose book, The Anthropology of Childhood, I urge anyone interested in the subject to read. The New York Times called it the only baby book you'll ever need. Drawing on his own and other fieldwork around the globe, Lancey shows that most of what we assume about growing up is confined to cultures he calls neontocracies, those that place children at the top of a pyramid of value and status and adults at the bottom. Most of the world, by contrast, consists of gerontocracies, in which the older you get, the more resources and attention you receive. They view children at best as desirable but pragmatically commodified chattel. Infants are not yet considered fully human, often kept swaddled or even hidden. They may be nursed longer than our children. In one tribe in Papua New Guinea, for instance, one of my favorite examples, they are not weaned until the age when they are able to recount their dreams, around about 3. Yet the long nursing is a matter of the mother's convenience, not a precarious process of bonding. When sow babies in Cameroon gaze at their mothers during nursing, the mothers blow on the infant's eyes to make them avert their gaze. Nor does the intense, purposeful interaction between older children and adults, which we think necessary for cognitive development, occur in village societies. Their children learn what they need to master their culture by carefully observing what older people do, be it catching fish, pounding grain, or performing rituals. And here I quote from Lancy, "Nowhere in the entire ethnographic record of childhood have I found any instance of a parent and child building a block tower together or anything else whose purpose is to entertain while also instructing the child." In order to show that the top-down pedagogy model is biologically based, all parents in all cultures should be engaging in this kind of behavior with infants because in the theory it establishes the foundation on which later teaching is built. But it doesn't, says Lancy. What does seem to be biologically based is the child's strong desire to be active, competent, and valued by the community. In traditional cultures, children do this by making themselves useful. First playing at pounding maize or planting yams, but very early gaining enough competence to perform truly valuable tasks from minding younger children, in particular to herding camels, and again the recognition and identity which that value brings. Such competence isn't gained through being treated gently, and we will blanch at some of the examples the anthropologists bring, from tribes in which toddlers are expected to learn how to handle knives by handling them, or those slow to learn to walk are placed on an anthill. Injuries, even deaths, are taken more lightly, but the result is that most 10-year-olds in traditional cultures produce more food than they consume. Just by the way, Lancy is well aware of the abuse involved when millions of children are forced to labor outside their homes in mines or brothels or garbage dumps. But condemning this doesn't exclude us from questioning the ways in which our children are exempted from making contributions at all. And whether their labor is exploited or merely taken for granted by their families, one thing is certain: those who grew up in such cultures don't get wistful or nostalgic when they speak of childhood. Until pretty recently, this was true of Europeans too. Descartes thought the reason for human unhappiness is the fact that we begin our lives as children, and apart from an occasional fond word for his mother, no classical author from Greece to China left a record of his childhood as golden or expressed particular yearning for it. Since the rate of infant mortality imploded, we began having fewer children and paying more attention to the ones we have. Many would say too much attention. But lest this obscene, in several senses, form of coddling make you nostalgic for those Spartan societies where children do chores without complaining, let's recall what non-weird cultures are missing, namely most forms of choice. The parts on their stages allow for little variation, and the roles are largely fixed in advance. Members of village societies take the lives that are laid out for them. Nay, even further, they vie for the lead in the limited roles. For, like Tom Sawyer's whitewashing fence model, every culture has ways of getting its vital work done by presenting it as a prize to be coveted. A village dweller competes to become the best hunter in the forest, as the hedge fund manager competes to be the best in her firm. What they do not do, with very recent exceptions, is ask the question, what do I do with all this freedom? This is a question that arose in the Enlightenment, for it was the Enlightenment that broke with the assumption that your freedom will be no greater than your father's was. Only with the Enlightenment did the question of choosing a life path arise. There are people in this room who know me well enough to know that if you listen to me for a while, you're bound to hear a reference to Kant or to Dylan. But deep personal attachments notwithstanding, there's a reason to turn to the Enlightenment when thinking about coming of age. You may get most of your information from YouTube, but the problems of growing up are structural, and they're not the result of internet dependence or the financial crisis. Though these may have made growing up harder in the last decade or so, the difficulties go much deeper. If weird cultures have been the exception, it's sad but safe to say that in another couple of decades, Apple and Facebook and Google and some corporation we have yet to imagine will ensure that the rest of the world follows the Western model. Let's look at its roots. To do this, I'll turn to my two favorite dead white men, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Immanuel Kant. It's no accident that the problem of growing up was central for both of them. They came of age in a world that was just beginning to allow that your choices might be more and other than your parents were. Though it would be hard to find two more different characters, they shared something very important. Both came from barely educated families of small craftsmen. Rousseau's father made watches, Kant's father made saddles, and it's quite certain that neither ever imagined the lives their sons turned out to lead. Kant wrote that Rousseau, on whom he bestowed the coveted epithet Newton of the mind, changed his life entirely, and a portrait of Rousseau was the only picture that graced the Königsberg professor's home. Even more than Newton's, Rousseau's texts formed the background to Kant's work. Though he said he found the Swiss author's sentences so overwhelmingly beautiful that he had to read them several times over before he was calm enough to reflect on their content. Knowing facts like these should change our picture of the dry sage of Königsberg, as well as the wild star of Geneva, and allow us to read their work anew. Consider Kant's most famous essay, which sent generations of German high school students to sleep. Though it was written for the 18th century equivalent of the New York Review of Books, the piece is confusing, so it eschews academic jargon, but it's nevertheless, at first glance, a mixture of banality, contradiction, and an embarrassing amount of flattery. When you look at it at first glance, he seems to be saying, our age is an age of enlightenment, but only Frederick has already got there. Since he's not afraid of shadows, there's more freedom in his kingdom than there is in a republic. I've sometimes thought the piece should be read as an open letter to Frederick, in which case the message, shorn of rhetoric, would go something like this. Your Majesty, you're old and weak, and fanatics are counting the days till they can take over your reins. And in thinking circles, to put it mildly, your reputation is not the best. Lessing wrote that no land in Europe is as well subjugated as yours. Even in Vienna or Paris, there's more freedom of political thought. Your scandalous treatment of Voltaire seems to confirm his arch-rival Rousseau's claim that intellectuals are only tolerated so long as they do nothing more than weave garlands of flowers around the chains that bind us. And nevertheless, out here in Königsberg, we know the difference between enlightened and absolute despotism. We need not look all that far to the east to see how much worse things could get. You haven't done much, but you've opened a door for improvement that plenty of people would be happy to close. For what do you want to be remembered in history? Playing the flute? I beseech you, show some courage. Send us a sign. Yours truly, Immanuel Kant. Kant did think a great deal about both education and politics, and if this was his real message, it was less in order to flatter the king than to portray an ideal of the ruler to which Frederick should aspire. for the times were threatening and reactionary forces were gathering. As Frederick's death grew nearer, Kant wrote another piece for the same publication, and its tone was almost hysterical, for he feared that Frederick's successors would undo his modest but genuine achievements. And indeed, temporarily, history would confirm Kant's fears. But the text has multiple layers, and if those were Kant's reasons to write the text in 1784, they aren't the reasons to read it in 2015. Those reasons are the heart of the text, and they speak equally to those who would be truly enlightened rulers as to those who would dare to be citizens. If you only remember one line Kant wrote, it's likely to be the first sentence of what is enlightenment, namely, enlightenment is humankind's exit from its self-incurred immaturity. The fact that the essay is far more readable than his scholarly texts makes it all the more puzzling that so few people bother to read or anyway remember more than that sentence. Like Jake's speech in As You Like It, the essay's fame has done nothing to ensure that it's properly read. Those are, to be sure, splendid sentences. In them, Kant tells us that our immaturity is self-incurred because its cause is a lack of courage. Not ignorance or stupidity, but laziness and cowardice keep us from thinking for ourselves. It's so easy to be immature. It's so comfortable to let others make decisions for me. Now, he's right, of course, and even the most independently minded of us will acknowledge the occasional truth of his claims, like, I have no need to think, if only I can pay, others will soon take over the tiresome business for me. And it is very often indeed our own fault. We're unwilling to summon the energy or run the risks, even the risk of embarrassment, that thinking for ourselves would demand. It's very easy to see why this is the message that teachers emphasize when they teach the text in high schools. Surely we don't want the young to think there's anything wrong with society that a little hard work and effort on their part can't fix. So in Germany, at least, the message of what is enlightenment became a liberal mantra that only strengthened existing orders, namely, any dissatisfaction you may feel with the world around you is your fault. If only you could get rid of your own laziness and cowardice, you could be enlightened, grown up, and free. Which makes it not surprising that Germans of a certain age who had to memorize the essay in school roll their eyes and groan at the very mention of selbstverschuldete Unmündigkeit. But as with Jake's speech in As You Like It, most people remember a line and forget its context. For Kant is not preaching neoliberalism. He does not believe that your dissatisfaction is your fault alone. You may tend, as I do, to laziness and cowardice, but Kant says those tendencies are abused. There are guardians who have taken over the task of supervising the rest of us by convincing us that independent thinking is not only difficult but dangerous. And here I quote, again, this is only like three sentences after the famous one. After the guardians have first made their domestic animals, house fee, dumb, and prevented the placid creatures from daring to take a step on their own, the guardians emphasize the danger that threatens them if they try to go alone, which intimidates them and generally prevents them from ever trying. Now, this is a radical and powerful political message. Our inability to grow up is not, or not only, our own fault. The social structures within which we live are constructed so as to keep us childish. The state has an interest in preventing us from thinking independently, and it cultivates and exploits our worst tendencies in order to do so, for grown-up citizens are more trouble than they're worth. The state's desire for control and our desire for comfort combine to create societies with fewer conflicts, but they're not societies of grown-ups. Now, what guardians did Kant have in mind? He was living in feudal times when even enlightened rulers were paternalistic, and paternalistic was not yet a term of abuse. It's easy to see how feudal structures kept their subjects infantilized, but haven't Western democracies done away with this sort of thing? Well, to a point. It can't be an accident that the most powerful and long-serving chancellor in Europe is regularly called Mutti in the German press. Nor that Merkel's main message to her voters is a message meant to soothe. Keep doing what you're doing, let Mutti take care of it, and nightmares like Greek debt and Spanish unemployment will be kept safely at bay. But let's call that mere metaphor, important metaphor, but not a real description of how Western democracies work. They don't, after all, have recourse to the paternalistic and authoritarian measures available to the guardians in Kant's time. Given that lack, how might a modern democratic society work to keep us infantilized? Now, taking care of infants is exhausting, but conceptually speaking, it's not that hard. A baby who's just learned that she can act on the world by coordinating hand and eye to grasp an object, a wonderful achievement, may grasp the wrong thing, her father's glasses, her mother's earrings, the knife they failed to take off the table, but it's so easy to distract her. All you have to do is put something else in her way, a bunch of keys will usually do it, and the baby is diverted, the objects you don't want her to reach now completely forgotten. As she grows, distraction becomes more difficult, but the principle remains the same. You wheel your two-year-old through the grocery store, telling her that food can't be eaten before it's paid for, that some things are better or healthier to choose than others, that the packages they're wrapped in often hide more than they reveal, and generally done your best to introduce her to the complex web of social interaction required to provide nourishment in a 21st century city. Finally, you reach the checkout line, where she lights upon a brightly gleaming and relatively expensive row of nutritional garbage, rows of them, in fact, placed precisely at the eye level of a child in a cart whose capacity for delayed gratification has just been sorely tested for the past hour. The industrial psychologist who designed that deserves a special place in hell. So how to distract your child now? Different things will work with different two-year-olds, and that on different days. Sometimes a firm no and a reminder that she's about to go to the playground. Sometimes a banana and a revision of the lesson that things have to be paid for before they're consumed. On bad days, you may throw a little tantrum yourself or give in and buy the candy. What's important is that distraction is necessary for all but the most authoritarian parents who have no qualms about hitting a child who insists on something they don't want to give her. Now, distracting older people from objects of desire may be slightly more complicated, but whatever difficulty there may be is easily compensated for by the fact that the things that can be used to distract us are nearly limitless, and since the invention of cyberspace, probably literally limitless. Despite the existence of apps specially designed to make sure your distractions in cyberspace don't reduce your productivity, millions more people took time last fall to stare at Kim Kardashian's backside than to vote in the US midterm elections the week before. Now, to be sure, it takes less time to Google Kim Kardashian than it does to vote in America, where turnout has always been a problem that may only be of interest to Europeans wanting to understand why American politics are so awful. But Europeans shouldn't be too self-content. Websites confirm that an awful lot of them were watching Kim Kardashian too when they could, for example, have been reading Thomas Piketty. Let me make it quite clear. It happened to be the case that I was reading Thomas Piketty that week, but I was also watching Kim Kardashian with fascinated horror, but fascination just the same. I'm just as capable of being distracted as anybody else is, though I may call that distraction part of a project of understanding the world I live in and adding a little critical cultural commentary, but I would vastly prefer to do without it. I wish I didn't know who Kim Kardashian is. For the record, my daughter tells me that adults like me can't possibly understand how awful the culture we're living in is since we're not on social media. She's probably right. I know plenty of adults who belong to the billion members of Facebook and others who urge me to appreciate the haiku-like nature of Twitter. I don't intend to join them, even in the service of understanding the ninth circle of 21st century hell. For other things distract me just fine without them. My computer had been sputtering, as it's programmed to do shortly after the guarantee runs out, and I finally ordered a replacement, but new features had been added or changed in the name of improvement, and the actions I'd learned to do without reflection all had to be unlearned. If we added all the hours spent by all of us are on what are cheerfully called upgrades, figuring out how to set the new alarm clock, grill with the new oven, store messages on the new smartphone, save pictures on the new camera, unlock the new auto ignition, wouldn't it be enough hours to, say, produce enough food to feed the world's hungry children, or perhaps a cure for cancer? At the risk of sounding nostalgic, I will mention the only mildly unpleasant thing I know about Immanuel Kant. His house was next to a prison, and he complained bitterly about the hymns sung by prisoners, which distracted him from his work, even writing to the mayor of Königsberg asking for help. The letter closed with the words, "I do not think they would have cause to complain or that their salvation would be in danger if their voices could be heard by each other when the windows were closed," end quote. It's hard not to be wistful if that's what counted as distraction in late 18th century Königsberg. No wonder they needed authoritarian mechanisms of control. Feudal authoritarian mechanisms for keeping subjects infantilized have given way to more subtle ones, but they're no less powerful and certainly more pervasive for all that. Contemporary mechanisms range from the growing practice of keeping us all under electronic surveillance or industry's ability to keep us dazzled by a bewildering number of choices of smartphones or breakfast cereal while keeping the important choices out of our hands. Totalitarian regimes are seldom necessary and usually counterproductive. For wherever the mechanisms of control are clearly present, some bold souls will be moved to contest them. Here, perhaps a shout out for those heroic people in Russia or China or Saudi Arabia who do it all the time. Simpler and subtler are the infantilizing processes of non-totalitarian societies that encourage our natural laziness by giving us comfort through a range of toys. Of course, neither smartphones nor automobiles are described as toys. Crucially, they're portrayed as the tools without which no adult life is complete. By contrast, ideas of a more just and humane world are portrayed as childish dreams to be discarded in favor of the real business of acquiring toys, that is, finding a steady job that fixes our place in a consumer economy. It's a perfidious reversal that leaves us permanently confused. That confusion in its infancy gave rise to Peter Pan and accounts for his popularity to this day. Just this year, major theaters in New York, London, and Berlin all produced new and different versions of the play, confirming my suspicion that the appeal of the boy who won't grow up is still very much with us and capable of new transformations. It's the transformations that are interesting, for they document the changes in our picture of growing up. It's a sad, bad business from the start, but in the original novel, it's merely boring. In 1911, Barry described Mr. Darling's knowledge as confined to stocks and shares. His only passion is being exactly like his neighbors. In the mid-century film version that many of us were raised on, Mr. Darling was still the consummate grown-up, that is, still deadly dull and possibly a little silly, but also possibly deadly. His authority is slightly menacing, and the booming voice can so easily turn threatening that the same actor could play both Mr. Darling and Captain Hook. Let's suppose the double casting was not about reducing production costs, but showing that Peter Pan needs to fight both. By the end of the 20th century, however, the grown-up has become ridiculous. My children grew up with the brilliantly disturbing twist on the story in Steven Spielberg's Hook, a film I disliked intensely, but only understood why when I saw it again this year. In it, the adult, now an overworked lawyer named Peter Panning, is still boring and miserable, but crucially, he's no longer the object of fear, but of contempt. By the end of the 20th century, the adult is so pitiful that the camera leads us to join in the youngster's mockery of him. So in less than a century, grown-ups declined from the merely dreary to the positively pathetic. Now, Spielberg is a moralist, so there's a happy ending of sorts where virtue is rewarded and villainy trounced. Peter Panning discovers one good thing about being a grown-up, namely being a parent, and this discovery saves the day. But the problem is that Spielberg has radically dimmed the glow of parenthood with Dustin Hoffman as Hook's brilliant attempt to seduce Panning's children. Spielberg's evocation of the downsides of parenting, not only its tedium, but something we might call its dishonesty, reminds us that the ending is not all that happy. We've been reminded of the softer side of adulthood, the love for one's own children that really is like nothing else in the world, and made to remember that even that is hard. It may have infinitely greater value than ringing phones and mortgage payments and the other sorts of things that grown-ups are meant to do, but it too breathes disappointment. Growing up as giving up, climbing trees as beneath one's dignity, and growing up as giving in to a life of pinching pennies and shouldering burdens with a worried air. I'm quoting from the 50s musical, whose lyrics I probably know by heart, but which are not in the end among Broadway's greatest. Still, Peter Pan's status as emblem has held steady for 100 years, not just for cases like Michael Jackson, but for some of the people I most cherish, those whom I mentioned in the beginning as very successful grown-ups. For those who view him as hero, Peter Pan is a symbol of rebellion against a system that seeks to bend us into shapes that fit a penny-pinching or penny-wasting society, so burdened it no longer knows how to live. When we're surrounded by voices that urge us to play the parts that have already been written for us, Peter Pan seems a rejection of resignation. But what if we've got it exactly backwards? What if we live in a culture that doesn't really want grown-ups, for self-obsessed infantile citizens are easier to manage? This is Kant's claim in What is Enlightenment, however often it's been ignored. And if that's true, what better way to keep people in self-incurred immaturity than to present such a dismal vision of adulthood that no one with soul and spirit could possibly aspire to it? Then it isn't Peter Pan's rebellion that is genuinely subversive, but on the contrary, the decision to embrace growing up with all the freedom and self-determination that implies. Of course, I'm not suggesting that Barry was in the pay of nefarious forces who plotted to make adulthood look singularly unappealing. From what we know about Barry and his rather questionable fascination for little boys, he was convinced of the vision himself. As are most of the people whose interest this vision serves, as I've tried to show with the rampant misreadings of Shakespeare, we're very ready to collude in our own downfall. Shame, disappointment, and a false commitment to stoicism all combine to convince us that resignation to reality is the mark of adulthood. And I've argued in my book, on the contrary, that being grown up means being able to face the split between the world as it is and the world as it should be, that Nietzsche called the metaphysical wound in the universe, without ever giving up on the claims each one makes on us. This stance is so precarious that it requires a permanent struggle for balance, and as such is just the opposite of the stasis for which adulthood is known. Immaturity, therefore, is not just practically, but metaphysically easier to sustain. Nor does it require deliberate planning to maintain. What's really hard is the attempt to overcome it. It seems, alas, long ago now, but many will recall that Obama's speeches during his first campaign were praised for treating the American people like grown-ups. 2 years later, the right-leaning press began calling him a professor, which is the kiss of death for Americans in a way that Germans can't imagine. And just a year after that, he was faced with ever louder attacks from the so-called birthers, whose racism was disguised as a claim that Obama was born outside the U.S., which would have made him constitutionally unqualified to serve as president. So, if immaturity is much harder to resist than to sustain once started, it's worth pointing out that though many oppressive features of the social world arise without design, making conspiracy theories unnecessary, one crucial idea, planned obsolescence, was actually the work of a cartel. Until the early 20th century, those who made objects or owned the factories in which other people made objects proceeded on the assumption that good things ought to last. Hannah Arendt described the desire to create something of value as central to human being itself. And I quote from The Human Condition, "Without taking things out of nature's hands and consuming them, and without defending himself against the natural processes of growth and decay, the laboring animal could not survive. But without being at home in the midst of things whose durability makes them fit for use and for erecting a world whose very permanence stands in direct contrast to life, this life would never be human." The dignity thereby present in both things and their makers was upended in a 1924 meeting in Switzerland when a cartel of electric manufacturers agreed to reduce the life of light bulbs, at the time averaging 2,500 hours, to 1,000 hours, thereby more than doubling, of course, the number of light bulbs sold. It's the first recorded instance of manufacturers deliberately planning to diminish the quality of their products, but it's probable that the cartel and the fines it levied on those subsidiaries which were reluctant to degrade their light bulbs were unnecessary, for the idea was in the air. In 1928, the young advertising journal Printers, Inc. proclaimed that an article that refuses to wear out is a tragedy for business. The auto industry discovered that early, which allowed General Motors to dominate the market by 1931, edging out Henry Ford, who had clung to the old-fashioned idea that goods should be built to last. The actual phrase planned obsolescence wasn't used until 1932 when the American entrepreneur Bernard London argued that the government should make it compulsory in order to reduce unemployment during the Great Depression. But this proved unnecessary, for the advertising industry was learning that seduction was more effective than legal force. Social critics as different as Paul Goodman, Vance Packard, and David Reisman deplored the introduction of planned obsolescence half a century ago, which is probably the reason the term went out of use and was replaced by the woolier product life cycle. Life cycles sound normal, part of a natural organic process of birth and decay. We now find it natural that most of the objects we use will need to be replaced before we've finished paying for them. We no longer pause to consider what this unnatural form of production does to us. Those whose workday consists of making or selling things designed to deconstruct, as well as those whose leisure consists of buying them. As producers and consumers, we're preoccupied with toys, while truly adult questions, who runs the world and what are the mechanisms by which we could change it, are dismissed as naive. In a rare private disclosure, Steve Jobs said the question of which dishwasher to buy dominated discussion at his family dinner table for weeks. He offered this as an example of democratic deliberation. I'd be surprised if similar attention was devoted, say, to the question of labor conditions in apple plants in China. Ask questions like these, or about the relative amounts of money available for military spending and for food and education, and you're likely to be treated like the child in the emperor's new clothes. Everybody knows it, and nobody wants to acknowledge it, and those who insist on it should feel ashamed for stating the obvious. I want to conclude with thoughts about the topic that arose through the discussions I've had about the book in different countries this past half year. Misunderstandings are always, in the first instance, the author's own fault, but some misunderstandings struck me as culturally revealing. German readers were used to the interweaving of the personal and the political in late capitalist cultural criticism, but what many of them missed was something different entirely. The German language has no word for ageism, and it shows. Commentary that would be offensive in today's US or Britain is German journalism's commonest coin. When Angela Merkel turned 60 last summer, I was appalled to see how many papers speculated about whether she would do the decent thing and retire. I am no fan of the chancellor, but millions of other people are, and since being head of state is one of those things you get better at with experience, the people who put her in office ought to hope she remains there for many years. By the way, it's worth pointing out, since it's sometimes claimed that women get a harder time with ageism, Germans are gender neutral on this score. When Gerhard Schröder visited an old age home during his last campaign, one journalist had the chutzpah to ask him directly, "Are you looking to reserve your room here?" He was at the time 62. But forget newspaper commentary. I was more dismayed when my first efforts to explain the book to German colleagues fell absolutely flat. If I was encouraging people to grow up, they concluded, I must be inveighing against what Germans call Berufsjugendlichen, those 60-year-olds who, by clinging to their motorcycles or colorful clothing, refuse to act their age. My point was exactly the opposite, but somehow the German associations with the words grow up is a sort of stern, finger-wagging, joy-killing lecture. Jetzt ist der Spaß vorbei. The association is so strong that a photographer for a Swiss paper that was doing an article on me and this book was instructed by the editor to take a very grim picture and kept telling me not to smile. I've been asked several times whether problems with growing up aren't a result of the 60s. The 60s generation has been blamed for so much, so thoroughly, that it's time someone made an inventory of all we have to thank them for, but that's another story. Most recently in England, a listener suggested that the problems I've been describing are products of baby boomer resentment. So he argued those who grew up in the 60s enjoyed breaking all the boundaries in their youth. Not only do they want to keep on doing so, but any criticism they now have of the idealization of youth is an expression of resentment at being driven from the spotlight by the next generation, a fate, after all, that they brought on themselves. Weren't they the ones who declined to trust anyone over 30? There are a number of responses to this kind of objection, one being that the glorification of youth began not in the 60s, but at the very latest with Peter Pan. But more importantly, just to put in a word against the ritual 60s bashing, the 60s were a rebellion against the idea that our lives must be determined by patterns and structures we do not control. Many of you will remember the song Little Boxes. If those who refused to take the parts on the stage that were set for them then, why ever should they slip into them now? Now, my intention has been to open a discussion rather than complete it, and I'm well aware of how many aspects of growing up my work left aside. And showing that major philosophers considered growing up to be the hardest problem humankind ever faces, both individually and collectively, I hope to have done something to bring philosophy back home. Finally, I've been asked if the fear of growing up is just the fear of growing old, and that fear nothing but the fear of death. My sense is that people in their 20s think more about death than those in their 50s and 60s. The closer we get to it, the less inclined we are to waste the time we've got left reflecting on death as an existential problem. We look with bemusement on Dorian Gray, and I want to quote Oscar Wilde here. Yes, there would be a day when his face would be wrinkled and wizened, his eyes dim and colorless, the grace of his figure broken and deformed. The scarlet would pass away from his lips and the gold steal from his hair. The life that was to make his soul would mar his body. End quote, Oscar Wilde. We prefer the life that makes our souls to the unmarred bodies of our youth. once again go back to Jake's view of the life cycle, which is so very much not Shakespeare's that he follows Jake's speech with the entrance of another character, Adam, who says, "Though I look old, yet I am strong and lusty." In the end, I believe that fear of growing up is less a fear of dying than a fear of life itself. Or do you really believe the best thing would have been never to have been born? Thank you.
Werdet erwachsen, es lohnt sich und macht Spaß, sagt die Philosophin Susan Neiman. Ihr Vortrag hieß Why Grow Up? Director's Cut. Sie hat den am 11. Juni 2015 im Einstein-Forum in Potsdam gehalten. Morgen senden wir im Hörsaal dann übrigens eine Gegenrede. The Case Against Growing Up heißt der Vortrag des New Yorker Literaturkritikers James Wood. Und morgen gibt es auch noch einen zweiten Vortrag im Hörsaal. Darin fragt die Historikerin Diana Pinto, wie man erwachsen werden kann, wenn man keine Heimat hat.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Samstag und Sonntag von 18 bis 19 Uhr.